Greetings and welcome to Longevity Now, the place for all your news and views of life extension from around the world. To begin, I want to once again thank the members of Longevity for their annual donations. Sure, there are some benefits to becoming a member in the forum and elsewhere, but more importantly, the donations support small grants to affiliated labs around the world. The grants are not large, but they are a definite sign of support from the life extension community. One researcher who has received the small grants for several years in a row now is Dr. Matthew O'Connor, co-founder of Cyclarity Therapeutics. His research into artery-clearing drugs is progressing steadily, and there is a lot of very positive information about their products and some interesting insights into the regulatory approval process within this podcast. And now I would like to welcome to the Longevity Now podcast, Dr. Matthew O'Connor, co-founder of Cyclarity Therapeutics. Welcome again, Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Justin. It's great to be back on the Longevity Now podcast.
Yeah, it was 2.5 years ago, believe it or not, since the last time we spoke. And just to catch people up, we can go into at what point you were in your research with cyclodextrins and combating atherosclerosis. You were just saying that you were ramping up toward cell tests of your lead therapeutic and finishing up GMP manufacturing and also looking forward to clinical trials starting in, say, mid-2023. So there's three things there. If you could catch us up to speed here on how that progressed. You did release a paper, I know, on your in vitro tests and a couple of other papers. And I assume that your manufacturing is going well, but and then the clinical trial aspect. Could you catch us up to speed there?
Sure. Well, it's a little embarrassing that I claimed we were going to be in clinic in 2023, and we haven't quite started yet, but that is actually imminent. We have a clinical trial plan, protocol, and site picked out and ready to go. One big thing that's changed since last time we spoke is that we've finished all commonly called in the US and you know sometimes in shorthand worldwide, IND enabling studies are all done. IND stands for investigational new drug, which is what the FDA requires for you to start clinical trials. So those have all been completed and we've submitted our package actually in Australia to the regulatory authority there, the equivalent of FDA in Australia. And our approval is pending. You know, hopefully we're going to get final good news on that any week now. And then we will have full approval and permission to start our trial in Australia. And, you know, one detail to add on to that, you know, we talked about manufacturing before, which was all going well. And now what's advanced from that isn't just the large scale manufacturing, the quality of the manufacturing, all of the analytics, but it is actually in single sterile, single use vials labeled ready to go into patients. So that's all ready to go.
And then how did your in vitro studies turn out? Give us an idea for people who didn't read the paper, the success or the trouble that you had in assessing the effectiveness of your new therapeutic?
Yeah, so those all went really well. And next we should talk about our in vivo successes also more recently. But on the in vitro front, the real big goal and achievement there was taking macrophages and feeding them just a little bit of our drug target, which is oxidized cholesterol. So we give them just a little bit of oxidized cholesterol, which is a little different from what most groups do with trying to foam up macrophages. So what most groups do is they just overload them with lipids. And what we do is we just give them a tiny bit of oxidized cholesterol. And that by itself is enough to rapidly turn macrophages into foam cells. And foam cells are these nasty blobby cells that are kind of like senescent macrophages. It's stretching, you know, people abuse the word senescence for all kinds of cell types now. You know, I don't want to belabor that too much, but it's a transformation that macrophages undergo when they get overloaded. Typically, what's thought of is when they get overloaded with lipid, and it's key. It's been known since the 1950s that that's a key step in the progression of plaque in your arteries. So that's our target, is can we turn the foam cells back into healthy macrophages? And that's the mechanism of how our drug works, is it clears out the oxidized cholesterol target. And then what we've been able to show, and we've published and are in the process of publishing, that we can actually completely reverse the foam cell phenotype, which, to my knowledge, has never been done before. Okay. So it's kind of like taking a senescent cell and turning it back into a healthy young cell. And we can do that with macrophages that have become foam cells.
Become foam cells. And your therapeutic targets a specific oxidized cholesterol, 7-keto cholesterol. Correct?
That's exactly right. It's kind of a mouthful to say 7-keto cholesterol or 7KC for short. The reason that we are targeting that very specific species of oxidized cholesterol is because you get into the weeds pretty quickly, but if you take a random oxygen-free radical, and throw it at a random molecule of regular cholesterol, more often than not, most often, you end up with that particular species of 7-keto cholesterol or 7KC. So I use those terms interchangeably.
Okay.
So that's our very specific target. And targeting that turns out to be sufficient to rejuvenate the macrophage and bring it back to health, no matter how we foam it up.
So there might be other forms of lipids that are interfering with the macrophage operation. But when you notice you remove the 7-keto cholesterol or degrade it, get rid of it, that is sufficient to return those macrophages to a state of a previous phenotype, healthy.
And what we think is happening there is that the macrophage is the foaminess of a macrophage is the bulk lipid that they are storing and sequestering and, you know, sort of filling up with literally, but only a tiny, tiny percentage of that lipid is our target 7KC. And so what we think is happening is just by removing the toxic 7KC, that allows the macrophage to go back to processing all the other forms of lipid that it's filled up with. And then it can metabolize them, it can export them, it can do reverse cholesterol transport again. These are all things that we've shown in our foam cell model. We've done a lot of different work, a lot of different experiments on, you know, different types of macrophages from different species, and, you know, foaming them up in different ways, you know, giving the drug first and the lipid after, or at the same time, or the lipid first and then the drug, all the different permutations you can think of, all the different measurements of the function, how the cells look, how much lipid they have, how their reverse cholesterol transport, we've quantified that. The phagocytosis, which is the core job of the macrophage, which is to eat, it goes away and then it comes back when we treat with our drug. All of those things, the gene expression profile, all of those things we've dissected and gotten to the bottom of. And we have a manuscript that your readers can look up on BioArchive that publishes part of this story without peer review. And now it's been submitted for peer review with additional data added to fill out the story.
All right. Well, you just teased us a couple of minutes ago with some in vivo results you wanted to mention.
Yeah. So the most important aspect of in vivo work to get done before you go into clinic is to get the animal safety and pharmacology work done. So for the most part, the regulators don't care that much about whether or not your drug will work as they care about, or how it works, as they care about how safe it is, at least at the earlier stages of clinical trials. So safety is the name of the game. So we've done an enormous amount of safety work now in small and large animals to show that our drug is well tolerated at extremely high doses. It's well tolerated at rather high doses over long periods of time, you know, being administered daily for up to a whole month.
Great results. I will remind listeners that you started out on this journey with Cyclarity, knowing that cyclodextrins were already used in foods and in medicine for many years already. So you kind of expected that the safety of your specific irrationally designed cyclodextrins would be pretty high. The safety would, and it seems to be turning out that way.
Yeah, and that was how we designed it. But we, you know, we invented a completely new molecule, a completely new form of cyclodextrin, you know, in fact, an entirely new family of cyclodextrins. And you don't really know until you put it through its paces that a new molecule is going to be as safe as you wanted it to be, or as that you designed it to be, or that you imagined it to be. So, and there are ways that cyclodextrins can be toxic. So we learned a lot from how, you know, cyclodextrins that have been made that have been very safe, how they were safe. And we've learned about from the ones that were made that turned out not to be safe, what was unsafe about them. So we learned from that and how, and designed our new drug to mimic the safety, the aspects of the safe cyclodextrins, and to avoid the pitfalls of the unsafe ones. So we definitely had a lot to be thankful of from, you know, previous groups' experiences and, you know, stuff that's been published in the literature. And
well, it's great to hear that the safety trials have gone so well so far. And you don't have to be embarrassed, like you mentioned earlier, that you were optimistic about your timeline for clinical trials. That happens very often, that, you know, it just takes a long time, it seems. What would you say has been the most difficult part about getting your new therapeutic into the clinical trial? Has it been the legal and regulatory busy work that you have to do? Is it funding? Is it labor? You don't have enough people, you know, working on your product? Or
the two biggest challenges have been funding and, you know, big picture, I'd say regulatory hurdles. There's a lot of nitpicks that you need to do. You know, for example, you make a tiny, you know, what you think is an inconsequential change to the formulation of your drug product that, you know, shouldn't change how your drug will behave in any meaningful way. But for some practical reason, you had to, say, for example, change the amount of salt that you put into the mixture. You may need to repeat a pretty big, long safety study before the regulators are fully convinced that it's safe for humans. And then there's a lot of little things that get added on top of that. Like, you know, you test the stability of your drug, but then what is the stability the same when it's in the form that's going to be delivered in? So if it's going to be in a syringe, is it safe in the exact same material that it's going to go into the patient in? So the same exact syringes that, you know, the nurses and the doctors are going to use to inject patients with, you have to test your drug in those exact same syringes that are going to be used in the trial, or the tubes or the containers or the bags.
Wow.
Anything that the drug's
going
to come into contact with,
you have to test.
Yeah.
Stuff to consider, because I mean, I would think though that they would know enough about what therapeutics and what chemicals interact with the plastic that is syringes are made out of and the bags are made out of and things like that. You would think that that would be an easier hurdle to pass, but apparently not.
Yeah, it's just, you always want to be safe rather than sorry. And there's lots of examples of unexpected drug interactions with different materials. So it's just a lot of I's to dot and T's to cross. But we've gotten through all of that now. And I think that the safety, the risk is now unimpeachable. We've done absolutely everything that anybody could possibly hope for. And we're very ready and excited to be getting started in people soon.
Yeah. And then I briefly mentioned funding. Sometimes that can be a roadblock to progressing faster. And I know you were trying to raise some money in the last podcast. I can't remember what series type funding you were going for. Any Word on that, are you still looking for investors? Do you have any specific funding needs right now?
Yeah, we are actually finishing the fundraise to be able to launch our first in-human clinical trial now. So it's definitely something that we're still in need of and something that has held us back and slowed us down a bit on this process. So, you know, I'm definitely still reaching out to and talking to investors, small and large, all around the world. And, you know, now that we have a product that's ready to go into people, it's a time in the biotech sector where valuations are pretty low. So we're a really good deal right now. And I think our value is about to explode. And I'm so excited about our recent results and progress. I'm going to put some of my own money into this round to help fund our first in-human clinical trials. Yeah. And not just because I want it to get done and because I believe in it so much. I actually think that it's going to be super profitable because we're just going to explode once the human results come out.
Right. And now the funding, though, also will determine the size of your clinical trial. Is that correct?
Well, the clinical trial has been designed, but there's to get into the weeds a little bit, there's two stages for our clinical trial. So we're talking to investors right now to finish the funding of the initiation of the clinical trial, which will fund the safety in young, healthy volunteers. And then we want to move smoothly into patients. And so we have a protocol and a PI, a doctor who will recruit and oversee from their own patient pool, a small number of patients for a safety and
efficacy,
you know, safety / efficacy. It's not, we can't really claim efficacy in phase one, but we'll look at some outcomes in the patients. We'll do imaging of their arteries before and after the treatment. We'll look at all of their blood markers. We'll look at the oxidized cholesterol excretion, which we now know from some brand new data in animals that I didn't get to tell you about yet, will happen. So we know now that patients will be excreting the oxidized cholesterol in response to our drug from our brand new results unpublished in animals. And so we'll be able to see that in the patients that'll be getting our drug in the second part of our phase one clinical trial. So that second part is still going to be contingent on us raising another a little less than $2 million after we initiate the first part of the phase one clinical trial.
Okay, I'm just going to ask a question here about the clinical trial since I've never run one myself, obviously, but I know I've read enough studies to see and to find enough failures in some clinical trials just to know how it goes and whether or not you will be able to get your therapeutic approved, even if there is no reduction in all-cause mortality as an endpoint. I didn't know if you had thought about that because some therapeutics recently have been approved if they just show improvement, like say in a target within the body, say if you had something that could reverse liver sclerosis, right? Liver gets rejuvenated, but the person still dies. Does your drug still get approved? Because I can imagine in the case of cardiovascular disease, you know, you've got some 60-year-old obese, sedentary alcoholic with multiple core morbidities. Now you might give them your therapeutic. It gets rid of the 7 keto cholesterol and their veins look great, you know, but they still, in 6 months, they pass on because of other, you know, health problems. Is that something that is considered in your trial or something that you're worried about?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it gets to our whole phase 1, 2, 3 clinical trial strategy. I'll try to keep it brief and, you know, okay, we can have some back and forth on this. But in short, in general, you have to show some measurable improvement in human health, whether that is a reduction in adverse events, which, you know, when you're talking about cardiovascular disease, you're talking about heart attacks and strokes, basically, and mortality, as you just pointed out. But what you were talking about previously was surrogate endpoints. Is there something that you can measure that's short of, you know, counting bodies after a long trial with a lot of people in it, you know, some on your drug and some not on your drug? You know, that's called a surrogate endpoint. If you can potentially get approval that without an outcomes measure. And so two examples of that in the cardiovascular space are LDL cholesterol and blood pressure. So if you come up with a drug that can lower LDL cholesterol or blood pressure, you can get a drug approved by FDA and other regulators on that basis, because it's been shown previously that there are some measurable health outcomes improvements from, either or both of those to improve outcomes.
Well, that's good to know, though, then, that you could have some other endpoints that could get the drug approved.
Yes and no. Improvement. So it's a little discouraging. So who cares about LDL or blood pressure anymore, right? There's plenty of great drugs that already do those.
Yep.
And, we've kind of plateaued. Like, people are tired of being told, you need to take more statins.
Because it's well known, statins don't reduce all-cause mortality. That's been several meta studies have shown that.
Yeah, not very well. If they do, it's marginal, and it's better in certain subpopulations of people. But overall, there's even studies, large scale studies of looking at total cholesterol in some populations, that higher cholesterol is associated with longer longevity.
I've seen those.
Reasons that aren't super well understood. I don't want to scare people away from taking their lipid lowering medications. There have been positive health outcomes associated with those, but it's not changing the game, and they don't get rid of the plaque in your arteries. So that's where we want to aim. Unfortunately, we're a little ahead of our time. Unfortunately, the regulators do not yet recognize the plaque in your arteries as a surrogate endpoint yet, because there hasn't yet been a definitive trial saying if you get rid of plaque in your arteries, your blood vessels, your veins, that it reduces mortality or it reduces heart attacks
or strokes. Well, that blows my mind. It blows my mind because it seems common sense. Now, I know in science, you have to do this study. You just can't rely on common sense. But it's been known for so long that buildup occurs, and the mechanistic action of that seems so obvious that you would think the regulators would be pounding the pavement to get something into trials to get rid of the plaque and just, hey, let's get going with this.
Exactly. And I really think it should change. The regulators are sometimes willing to make some assumptions and take some chances. For example, in Alzheimer's disease and A-beta, they've certainly stretched with less mechanistic connection between, getting rid of A-beta than the really obvious, as you point out, connection between literally having your blood vessels that are transporting your all-important blood around your body. It could be 90% blocked, and there is not yet a regulation that says if you take that 90% and drop it down to 50% or 10%, that it's that the person that you can make a safe assumption that they're going to be better off. Now, you ask your cardiologist, if I could clear out my plaque and my coronary artery, would I be healthier? They'll say, oh my God, of course you would. And so when I talk to cardiologists and I say, if I had this drug, would you want to give it to your patients? They're like, oh my God, every cardiologist in the world would want this for their patients. But sometimes the regulators can be a little bit conservative. These discussions are happening at some levels, and I hope that by the time our drug is ready for approval, that's our fantasy, is that we will be able to convince some regulators to make that assumption and start, at least on a provisional basis, start allowing patients to be prescribed our drug on that basis. That will reduce the amount of time that it would take us to get our drug to approval. And so I'm hopeful of that. But we have some alternative strategies for some smaller indications that we might be able to go for that could still get our drug to market faster.
Yeah, and I just want to mention that, some doctors, cardiologists, researchers, and funders do sometimes listen to the podcast here. If they wanted to get a hold of you, perhaps, to help out in the new round of funding, what's the best way?
Yeah, absolutely. People should contact me through our website, through my email address, which is matthew.o'connor@cyclarity.tx.com. You can look us up on our website, cyclarity.tx.com. Look us up on Facebook or LinkedIn. Send us messages through social media, and we will try very hard to get back to you right away. And anybody who wants to collaborate scientifically, who wants to get involved with helping us raise money for our trial, please contact me. I think I'm required to say this is not a solicitation for funding. And, you know, but if you're interested at all, if you want to find out about how to, you know, potentially volunteer for a clinical trial, you know, look us up. And, you know, if you really want to, if you're in the area or you're really, really motivated, you know, you can go to Australia and volunteer for the trial. There's lots of ways to engage with us. And even at that regulatory level, I want to engage with people, with people who are thinking about these challenges of how do you productively work with regulators, work with thought leaders in academia on how can we productively you know, make the regulations work best for patients, you know, by looking at biomarkers of aging, biomarkers of health and disease in ways that make a lot of sense to best serve patients in, you know, as quickly and helpfully as possible.
All right. Well, thank you. Hopefully we will have some people helping out in the future or volunteers for the clinical trial. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. O'Connor, and best of luck in the future.
Thanks so much, Justin. It's been a pleasure as always.
Now that was a real illuminating discussion about how difficult it is to get a new drug to market. It is great that Cyclarity has made it to the point of clinical trials in people. Another thing I hope you appreciate is that clearing out 7-keto cholesterol appears to be a treatment that could produce systemic benefits throughout the body. It might be one of the key types of metabolic junk that drives cellular dysfunction and aging. And if everything keeps progressing at Cyclarity, we will soon find out if that is true. Until next time, I'm Justin Lowe.